U.S. airstrike kills the leader of Islamist extremist group Al-Qaeda. Washington warns Beijing against turning the possible visit of U.S. Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan into a crisis. Victims of the Duterte drug war slam President Marcos's move not to rejoin the International Criminal Court. We'll get the reaction of the executive director of the Commission on Human Rights, attorney Jacqueline DeGuia. And later on in the program, we'll be joined by veteran journalist Linda Homilia on the late President Fidel V. Ramos's relationship with the press. Hi, I'm Carmina Constantino. Dateline Philippines begins right now. Thanks for joining us. For those of you watching us on YouTube and on Facebook, nice to have you with us today. We begin with America's war on terror, taking down the leader of Islamist extremist group Al-Qaeda. U.S. President Joe Biden announced Monday the death of Ayman al-Zawahiri in an airstrike in Kabul. Zawahiri, identified as a mastermind of the September 11, 2001 attacks, had been on the run ever since. He took over Al-Qaeda after Osama bin Laden was killed in Pakistan in 2011.
He carved a trail of murder and violence against American citizens, American service members, American diplomats, and American interests. And since the United States delivered justice to bin Laden 11 years ago, Zawahiri has been a leader of Al-Qaeda. To the families who lost fathers and mothers, husbands, wives, sons and daughters, brothers and sisters, friends and co-workers on that searing September day, it is my hope that this decisive action will bring one more measure of closure.
The American president also issuing this warning to those who are plotting against the United States.
Now, justice has been delivered, and this terrorist leader is no more. People around the world no longer need to fear the vicious and determined killer. The United States continues to demonstrate our resolve and our capacity to defend the American people against those who seek to do us harm. You know, we make it clear again tonight that no matter how long it takes, no matter where you hide, if you are a threat to our people, the United States will find you and take you out.
China issues another stern warning against the U.S. over U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's possible visit to Taiwan. Beijing's foreign ministry says a visit grossly interferes with China's internal affairs and would only lead to grave consequences. Washington firing back. It warned Beijing against turning Pelosi's visit into a crisis. The U.S. insists Pelosi has every right to visit the self-ruled island.
This is very much precedent in the sense that previous speakers visited Taiwan. Many members of Congress go to Taiwan, including this year. And so if the speaker does decide to visit and China tries to create some kind of crisis or otherwise escalate tensions, that would be entirely on Beijing.
House Speaker Pelosi is leading a congressional delegation to the Asia-Pacific region. Media reports have said Pelosi will make a stop in Taiwan on Wednesday. Ukraine resumes its grain exports with a first shipment bound for Tripoli. The cargo of 26,000 tons of corn left the port of Odessa Monday. The ship comes a month after Kyiv and Moscow signed a landmark deal with Turkey and the United Nations. Russia called the first grain shipment positive and a good opportunity to test the effectiveness of the accord. But Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says it's still too early to draw any conclusions. The U.S. also taking a cautious tone.
Keep in mind, there are something like 20 million tons that are in silos and in storage in Ukraine that's been held back by the Russian blockade of Odessa up until now, and it needs to get out. But the test is now really in the days and weeks ahead. More ships need to move. More grain needs to get to market. That's what will really make a difference.
Russia's invasion had blocked Ukraine's grain exports, which are one of the biggest in the world. This has led to soaring food prices across the globe. Here at home, a group of drug war victims slammed Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr.'s decision not to rejoin the International Criminal Court. A lawyer for Rise Up for Life and for Rights says government's investigation into drug-related killings during the Duterte administration has not been enough.
300 out of 6,000 is nothing. Certainly, there is no investigation of policy as well. So it would be incorrect for President Marcos to say that there is an investigation already ongoing in the Philippines. The point here is that this is not a simple crime. Mm-hmm. These are the most serious, the most heinous of crimes that are being tried before the ICC, crimes against humanity. This political decision not to pursue an investigation is a signal that only the rich and the powerful have the power or the authority or the opportunity to commit wrong in the Philippines. And then they get away with it.
The Philippine Coalition for the International Criminal Court also expressing dissatisfaction with how cases of drug war killings are faring under the country's justice system.
Usually, it's only the direct perpetrator who is filed a case and then convicted. In the case of Kian de los Santos, those who pulled the trigger, the police, were convicted, but we don't have anyone who may be guilty of command responsibility for all mm-hmm. these killings. It should, in fact, look at possible regional leaders who might have command responsibility, or even Senator Bato de la Rosa, who was the Philippine National Police Chief when the war on drugs started, and subsequent police chief.
Human rights group iDefend says it's not surprising that Marcos has chosen to protect his predecessor. Some lawmakers also against President Marcos's decision not to rejoin the ICC. House Deputy Minority Leader Franz Castro believes the president is not only protecting his predecessor from accountability, but it is also protecting himself if his administration commits human rights violations. This view shared by Attorney Edre Olalia, president of the National Union of People's Lawyers. Opposition Senator Risa Ontiveros hopes Marcos will not block ICC investigations into crimes that took place before the Philippines withdrew from the ICC. But Senator Francis Tolentino, the vice chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, fully supports the decision not to rejoin the ICC. Former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte refuses to submit himself to any ICC investigation into his bloody war on drugs. Duterte's private counsel, former palace spokesperson Harry Roque, says the former president will only face complaints filed before domestic courts.
And if there is probable cause, he is willing to face them, but before a Philippine court. And if he is found guilty for violating the Philippine IHL law, which restates the crimes punishable under the ICC, then he will face the consequences and face time in a Philippine jail. Under no circumstance will he allow any foreign prosecutor, any foreign judge, any foreign court to exercise jurisdiction over him. If for any reason that the ICC will continue to exercise its jurisdiction, he will go before Philippine courts for a restraining order to restrain the Philippine police from serving the warrant of arrest against him, because he will argue that the Philippine courts are able and willing to prosecute these cases, and therefore there's no basis for foreign institutions to interfere.
Well, let's get the reaction of the Commission on Human Rights. Now joining us is CHR Executive Director, Attorney Jacqueline Diguia. Attorney Diguia, good afternoon to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Yes, good afternoon, Carmina, and to all our viewers this Tuesday afternoon.
Well, it was just last week when you and I were talking over, I don't know, was it here or over on DZMM, but it was clear that you were then urging
President Marcos to reconsider joining the ICC. And now that you have his statement yesterday saying that this administration has no intention of rejoining the ICC, what are your thoughts regarding that?
Well, Carmina, we do respect the prerogative of the president. However, it is definitely unfortunate that the government has decided not to rejoin the ICC. If we are to look at this issue, we have to look beyond this administration and beyond the domestic boundaries that we are in. And we only have to look at Ukraine and Russia right now. And we do see that the ICC is an additional mechanism and an additional access to remedy that would have insulated and protected Filipinos and future generations from acts of war, from the most heinous, from the most drastic, as we do see now the trends globally in terms of conflict.
But when you listen to Attorney Harry Roque, Ukraine, Russia, and Sudan, we are not. We have functioning mechanisms here. Why do we need the ICC?
Well, there are instances when mechanisms domestically aren't that available. Say, for example, in Ukraine right now, because there's an ongoing conflict. Definitely, even if the courts want to remain functional, they cannot. And these are the situations we must contemplate in terms of assessing whether we have to join the ICC or not. And of course, we also have to look beyond this administration. If, for example, that is a stumbling block, we have to also make sure that in the future we guarantee the generations that they still have an access to remedy.
Here's the thing, though. We heard from Attorney Roque, the very person who pushed for the Philippines' membership into the ICC, but now he's calling it interference because we're now being investigated. Is it really interference, Attorney Deguia?
Well, if you were to look at the Rome Statute objectively, it does recognize the principle of complementarity. And therefore, if, for example, a country is able to demonstrate that its internal mechanisms are working, that the criminal justice system within a particular state is working, then the ICC won't step in. And in this case, what the ICC has mentioned in the past is that it's not enough. The things that are being done by the Philippine government is not enough. We need to see more cases being filed in the courts. And as Attorney Roque mentioned a while ago, they will submit to the jurisdiction of Philippine courts. We definitely have to see that if we were to stop the ICC from continuing its investigation here in the Philippines.
I think the deadline is September 8th. What must happen between now and then? So that the government can prove to the ICC that indeed the justice system here is working.
You know, the DOJ has commenced its review of 300 cases. Definitely that has to propel forward. It has to reach the DOJ. The prosecutors will have to file cases, and then the courts will have to make sure that there is accountability where there is sufficient basis and where there is none, at least come up with a finding or a decision that will satisfy all parties concerned.
But here we are, Attorney Deguia, talking about the here and now, talking about the case before the ICC involving the Philippines and its past precedent. But you mentioned a while ago that the membership goes beyond the case now. What are the repercussions here? Talk to us about the reverberations that may be felt post this administration, post this case, if we are to cease our membership or completely not rejoin the ICC?
You know, Carmina, we just have to look at the Ukraine experience for us to see the value of the Rome Statute or joining the ICC once again. In this conflict, it was definitely not of the wanting of the Ukrainian people to be subjected into a conflict. And the worst of the crimes have been committed against them. There is massive killings, there is rape, there is genocide happening there. And in those circumstances where the local police, where local courts can no longer function because they are basically fighting also for their survival and fighting for their sovereignty, you would now look for another mechanism, additional mechanism, an outside mechanism beyond your national boundaries that will now provide you access to remedies, that will provide you protection. And that is what the ICC guarantees, that there is an additional, there is an international mechanism that will be made available to victims that will make sure that justice, accountability will be guaranteed. And that is what's lost if, for example, any government, any administration will decide not to rejoin the ICC. So as I was saying a while ago, there has to be a distinction. We have to look beyond this administration. We have to look beyond the past administration. And we have to take into account what is happening globally. We do see, for example, that China is reacting strongly to the visit, to the intended visit of the U.S. Speaker. It may escalate into a conflict that may draw potentially, for example, Asian states. In that circumstance, we do hope that there are still international mechanisms that will afford us protection when there are none available domestically.
This, because really, Attorney De Gea, when you talk about reality, how can one expect an administration to investigate itself?
That's right. That's what we saw in the previous administration. But, you know, this administration is one step removed from the previous administration. It does have its own human rights track record to prove. It does have its own justice system to play out in the next 6 years. And so we hope that future decisions will take into account this context that we speak of.
People are saying that it's not really about this administration, why President Marcos has no intention at all of joining the ICC, but it's all about protecting the past administration. Is it protecting former President Rodrigo Duterte if the current president, President Ferdinand Marcos Jr., does leave the ICC out in the cold and not rejoin it? Is that protection to you?
Carmina, we haven't heard yet a categorical statement from the government on what are the next their next steps with regards to the ICC probe that is ongoing. What we have heard so far is their decision not to rejoin the ICC, which is completely separate and different, because the ICC, based on their pronouncement, continues to assume jurisdiction over the Philippine case or the previous administration. And we are keen on waiting future developments, whether as the OSG has mentioned, they are studying their options, whether or not to cooperate, whether or not to assert the principle of complementarity or not answer at all. Mm. So we're still waiting for a categorical statement from Malacanang.
Tell me something, though, Attorney De Gea. How can the Philippines turn its back on the Rome Statute, the foundation of which or on which the ICC stands, when its very creation was based on a Philippine Supreme Court ruling about the Yamashita versus Tyler case?
Well, Carmina, you know, it's worth mentioning that it's former Gloria Macapagal Arroyo administration which must be credited for joining the ICC. And in that regard, we did affirm that we will make sure that this statute remains to be an available mechanism for future generations for the worst kind of crimes. And this must not only contemplate, again, what is happening in the present, but it must also contemplate what may potentially happen in the future and even with international actors. So we do hope that, again, the government might revisit this position.
What does this decision, as it stands now, tell the international community and the majority of Filipinos, Attorney De Gea?
So right now, it does project that we renege on our formal commitments, because we have to understand that statutes, the covenants that we enter into are contracts. And this signals that, of course, the Philippine government may have a tendency to look into or revisit previous commitments it has done. And with regards to human rights, we do hope that this will not signal the beginning of a decline in its human rights commitment. We still hold on through the commitments uttered by President Marcos that they will make sure that the human rights protection and promotion will be guaranteed in this administration. And he did also mention that he didn't want to be judged by his ancestors, but by his actions. So we do hope that in the coming UPR, because we are going to be subjected to a periodic review in the UN at this end of the year, and through other human rights issues, we are increasingly able to demonstrate our compliance to these agreements and to our conventions. And at the same time, within the locality, we are able to make sure that we are able to let our justice system function as it should, swiftly and with guaranteed results, so that human rights is basically protected and ensured.
Commission on Human Rights Executive Director, Attorney Jacqueline Deguia, always a pleasure talking to you. Take care and keep safe. Thanks for joining us
today.
Thank you
very much, Carmina. Always a pleasure.
And from there, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Asia reports its first monkeypox fatality. Details when we return. You're watching Dateline Philippines here on ANC. And we're back. There's still a Dateline Philippines here on ANC. Here's another look at our headlines this noon. A U.S. airstrike kills the leader of Islamist extremist group Al-Qaeda. Washington warns Beijing against turning the possible visit of U.S. Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan into a crisis. And victims of the drug war slam President Marcos's move not to rejoin the International Criminal Court. Back with more news. India reports Asia's first fatality from monkeypox. The 22-year-old man recently arrived from the United Arab Emirates. He was admitted to a hospital in Kerala State with symptoms of encephalitis and fatigue. Tests later confirmed he had monkeypox. At least 20 close contacts are now in isolation. Peru also reporting its first monkeypox fatality, a 45-year-old man who had severe infection. An official said the patient already had a weakened immune system after abandoning treatment for HIV/AIDS. California declares a state of emergency over the monkeypox outbreak. Governor Gavin Newsom said the declaration will bolster California's response to the disease, especially with vaccination and treatment. Newsom adds testing capabilities will also be expanded. California has the third highest number of monkeypox infections in the U.S., next to New York and Illinois. In total, the U.S. has over 5,800 confirmed cases. The federal government is expected to distribute 800,000 doses of the monkeypox vaccine in the coming days. The Philippines detects its first two cases of the more infectious Omicron BA2.75 subvariant. The health department says the patients from Western Visayas have already recovered, but their exposure and travel histories are still being verified. They're among the more than 1,000 additional cases of Omicron subvariants reported by the DOH. Health authorities say COVID cases in the country remain manageable.
Bagamat patuloy po ang pagtaas ng ating COVID-19 cases, nananatili po tayong nasa low-risk case classification, at yan ay dahil sa ating masigasig na pagbabakuna at pagsunod sa minimum public health standards. Kaya naman po, patuloy lang po tayong maging bida at maging bahagi po tayo lahat ng ating Pinas Lakas campaign.
The BA.2.75, nicknamed Centaurus for its rapid spread, first emerged in India in May. It has since spread to around 10 countries. Moving on, a poll watchdog sees nothing irregular with the appointment of election lawyer George Garcia as chairman of the Commission on Elections. See, some concerns have been raised over Garcia's appointment. That's because he served as Marcos's election lawyer in 2016 in his electoral protests against former Vice President Lenny Robredo. But the Legal Network for Truthful Elections, or LENTE, says Garcia's background as an election lawyer would actually help him better serve the poll body.
Siya po ay commissioner ng COMELEC dito pong huling election natin, yung bago po siya na bypass ng ating commissioner ng appointments. Ang maganda po yung mga programang nasimula ni Commissioner Garcia, pati Commissioner Garcia, katulad po yung task force na on misinformation, disinformation. Yung po mga programa niya, bukas po siya eh, at ini-invite niya po yung mga stakeholders po tulad namin para marinig yung aming mga saloobin.
As for Garcia, he thanked Marcos for his continued trust. He vowed to be impartial and independent as COMELEC chairman. President Marcos appoints Labor leader Alan Tanhusay as Social Welfare Undersecretary. As Undersecretary for Inclusive and Sustainable Peace, Tanhusay will be overseeing the provision of welfare services in conflict areas, make that in conflict-hit areas, as well as the de-radicalization programs for rebel returnees and their families. Tanhusay says he is grateful to Marcos for the appointment. He also says he's eager to work with Social Welfare Secretary Erwin Tulfo. Tanhusay has served as a spokesperson for the Trade Union Congress of the Philippines. The labor group supported Marcos during the May elections. The House of Representatives approves a resolution backing the medium-term fiscal framework of the Marcos administration. The vote came after a grueling interpellation of its principal sponsor, Marikina Representative Stella Kimbo, by Albay Representative Edsel Lagman. Lagman called the framework mere planning targets by the government, but Kimbo argued the resolution is important since it indicates the policy direction of the Marcos administration in the next 6 years. The resolution would express the House and eventually the Senate's support for the economic targets of the government from 2022 to 2028 and the proposed strategies of the economic managers. It would also recognize the importance of a fiscal consolidation and resource mobilization plan. The leading online brokerage firm here in the country sees tough times ahead for the Philippine Stock Exchange. And Warren De Guzman now tells us why.
The Philippine stock market has been a weak performer this year. So far, the PSE Index has the second poorest performance for 2022 in Asia, with only South Korean shares doing worse. And while COL Financial notes local shares are at least doing better than stocks in Europe, the U.S., and other emerging markets, investors should not expect a good performance in the second half. A big reason for this is foreign investors are shunning Philippine stocks. The total net outflows from the PSEI this 2022 is 47.1 billion pesos so far. COL Financial says the combination of rising interest rates, fluctuating peso exchange rates, and high inflation has made the PSEI unattractive, and investors aren't likely to change their outlook on the Philippines soon. COL Financial Head of Research April Tan says the new administration's inflation policy will be key. Just last week, Central Bank Governor Felipe Medalla expressed concerns the new government's focus on food self-sufficiency might cause a premature departure from the importation strategy the Duterte administration successfully used to fight local shortages and food inflation.
It's a tricky balance. I think at this point, we're not yet prepared to abandon importations because maybe our agricultural sector is not yet prepared for it. But I think right now we still should be continuing with the importation of agricultural products. But I think side by side, they have to, or the government has to start working on the agricultural sector to increase productivity.
COL Financial's chief technician, Juanis Barredo, meanwhile, is watching global oil prices carefully for cues on where Philippine inflation might be headed. Based on his analysis of oil prices at the New York Mercantile Exchange, Barredo says there is a chance world crude prices can hover between $105 and $110 per barrel. But he also says slowing demand in the U.S. amid a technical recession could pull prices lower.
Even if we see $94 break, and that's the time that we'll probably see lower oil prices, maybe in the range of about $87.50 all the way down to maybe even $80 as a possibility. And I think if we can really see that, then that will help tremendously in putting inflation a little bit more on the path downward.
Michael Ricafort, chief economist at RCBC, meanwhile notes there has been some negative developments in factory output, with the Purchasing Managers Index slowing for a third consecutive month in July, falling to its slowest level in 6 months. Ricafort believes the slowdown is due to inflation raising the cost of inputs, but he is also quick to note that the PMI gauge is still above 50, indicating expansion. Finance Secretary Benjamin Diokno, however, is confident the Philippine economy will outperform in spite of high inflation. The DBCC's GDP growth forecast for 2022 is 6.5 to 7.5%. Diokno cites how the IMF upgraded its growth outlook for the Philippines while downgrading the forecast for the world economy. But for Tan, that may do little to stoke investor sentiment.
We will still see strong growth. But then again, considering that last year was a low base because we did some lockdowns, diba, around that period of time in the second quarter. So I guess for analysts like me also, we'll look for clues if how consumer spending will hold up even with the higher inflation.
COL says there is significant uncertainty and the PSEI could fall as far as 5,800 or rebound to as high as 6,800. Or it could simply hover between 6,450 and 6,130, which it has been doing over the last few weeks. Warren De Guzman, ABS-CBN News.
The Philippines observing a 10-day period of national mourning following the passing of former President Fidel V. Ramos. All Philippine flags will fly at half-staff during this period, while soldiers will wear black armbands for a month. An 8-gun salute was fired from dawn until dusk in the Philippine Army's headquarters in Taguig in honor of Ramos, who was also a former chief of staff of the armed forces. Ramos's family has yet to give details about his wake and burial. Former President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo also paying her respects to Ramos. She describes him as one of the greatest Filipinos of the 20th century and a giant among Philippine leaders. She also lauded the former chief executive for being a stabilizer amid coup attempts during her administration and that of late President Corazon Aquino. Arroyo calls on Filipinos to celebrate Ramos's life and emulate his love for country. Well, veteran journalists remember late President Ramos as a leader who understood the important role of the press. Our very own Linda Humila covered the Ramos presidency. She's now executive director of ABS-CBN News Digital, and she joins us now on the program. LJ, good afternoon. Nice to see you, and thanks for joining us today.
Casey, thanks for inviting me, and I'm really honored to be asked to speak about the late president. You know, I was observing some of the posts and comments of my former colleagues in the Malacañang Press Corps. And, you know, a lot of us were really saddened by what happened to the former president.
Well, LJ, I want to go back from the very beginning, from the very first time you actually covered the president or the former president. What was your impression of the late President Fidel V. Ramos then?
You know, I had no preconceived, except for what you read and what you know about him during his stint as in the military and the PCINP during the time of President Marcos Sr. and, of course, his role in the EDSA Revolution. But prior to that, I had no other preconceived notions about covering him because I did not cover him during the presidential campaign. Mm. So I think it was really... what do you call that? A tabula rasa, a white slate, no, when I first met him. And what struck me was that he was somebody who loved talking to people, and including journalists. You know, some presidents, some politicians, some leaders are very wary about talking to journalists. But he actually relished the fact that he would exchange ideas with the Malacañang Press Corps. He would sometimes lectures a little bit, but at the same time, you know, he was very generous sharing his insights and wisdom as someone who's been there and done that, having spent a long time in the military, in the police, as well as in government.
You know, some would say that he was actually, although he wasn't a social being, that, you know, he'd go to all these, you know, parties and gatherings, but what he was a person who actually got a lot of the energy from those people around him, but he also gave back. He was also very generous with his energy.
That's right. I can't think of any other politician who, or president or leader who you know, practically did not rest at all. When we were covering Malacanang, our weekends were spent going, following him all over the country. I remember whenever we would go to, he would go to Mindanao, to some place in Mindanao, and we would accompany him. The Malacanang Press Corps would accompany him. We had our own plane, which is, I think, a Fokker 27, and it was at that time, the presidential plane is a Fokker 28. So our travel time was double the travel time of the president. We would wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and, you know, leave for Mindanao, for some point in Mindanao, around 5 in the morning. But we were all energized by his own energy. We saw how enthusiastic he was about going about his work, you know, his relations with the people, and he actually really enjoyed himself. It wasn't just a job for him to do, a chore. It wasn't like that. It was really something that he wanted to do.
Mm. And how did that sort of impact you as a journalist, seeing his love for country, seeing how energetic he was to serve the people?
You know, I think, and a lot of people would say this, that FVR spoiled many of the media for, you know, the presidency, meaning anyone else who came after him, I think, was measured and probably found wanting, or at least not as enthusiastic as he was, because he really showed us, the media, those who covered him, how it was to be a leader of men, no? not just somebody who occupied the highest position in the land or the highest position in government, but somebody who led people and inspired people to follow him. We were all inspired. I would have to say, no, that it's not that we were all fawning over him or gushing over how smart or brilliant a leader he was. We had our moments of tension and conflict between the press and President Ramos or the Ramos administration, but that did not detract from our own honest and objective assessment of him as a leader, as a public servant, as somebody who was working so hard to reach out to a lot of the Filipinos. As you know, he only won 23-point-something% of the vote. He was a minority president. And so he spent his early years in office trying to reach out and consolidate support, but at the same time really getting to know, or letting the people get to know him.
Talk to us more about his relationship with the press. How would you describe this, LJ?
You know, I think if there's one word or a phrase that could describe how he dealt with media, it was really that he respected the media. He respected the press's role in a democracy. And so even if sometimes that relationship was not that warm or not that positive or not that cordial during certain moments in his presidency, and there were, you know, there were a lot of moments when he was also criticized. I think that the prevailing relationship was really one of respect. He was accessible. He was the only president who had a weekly press conference. And this is not some, you know, of course, there was no YouTube at that time or Facebook. But this is not a one-way thing where, you know, he would record a statement or a speech and ramble for like several hours. This is an actual press conference where the media get to ask him questions, get to challenge some of his assertions, and he would actually answer. Sometimes, you know, he was a bit snarky or sarcastic when he didn't like our questions. Mm. But at the end of the day, you get an answer from the president.
So now we go on to how, you know, how charming he was and what and the talker that he was. You've experienced this, but when the environment got, you know, things were getting to be sort of heated because of the numerous issues that he faced, because obviously his wasn't a perfect presidency. No presidency is perfect. But how did that change? Talk to us about any particular instance when you had to go around this charmer, this talker, And when things, when questions started to get uncomfortable for him to answer, tell us about those moments. And did the relationship, his relationship with the media change then when things got heated?
You know, I can't think of a particular incident, but I would remember that if there were some hard questions that we needed to ask, not just about government policy or about governance, but sometimes even on the personal level. Of course, you know, you have people around you when you're president who would try to convince the media na to ask this, wag na lang yan, or maybe, you know, let's forgo that question. But in the end, we are reporters, we are journalists, we want to do our job. And if you insist on asking a question, as long as probably you're not disrespectful or you accord the same respect to him, even if you're asking a tough or challenging question, then he would still answer. I cannot recall a time when he actually embarrassed or proceeded to humiliate somebody during a press conference. But you know, if you're a bit snarky in your questioning, then he would also snark back. I mean, you know, we all give as much as we get. No? So that's the relationship. And obviously, for a lot, despite whatever was written about him during his presidency, obviously he didn't bear any grudges, because you know you would still see him after he left the presidency. You'd see him guesting in a lot of radio and TV shows, or being interviewed by the press or the print media. He would have those mini press conferences in his office in Makati, the RPDev Foundation office. So you know that he still enjoyed that kind of relationship, whatever it was, you know, that transpired during the rough moments of his presidency. And towards the end, as you know, there was a controversy over his support for charter change, which some critics saw as a means, you know, to keep him in office longer than the 6 years. So that was a rather tumultuous time in terms of his, in terms of how he was covered by media. But I think, you know, after all of that, it was nothing to him.
Talk to us about dissent and how he treated it.
Dissent in, I'm sorry.
Dissent. Whenever he would encounter dissent, whether it's from the media or from the general public, how did he treat it during his presidency?
You know, the one of the best things that I appreciated about President Ramos, and appreciated it more after, you know, he left office and after several presidents came after him, is that he was really a decent person. He was never one who would, you know, blackball anyone or ball out anyone, even considering his military background. I can't recall any incident where, you know, he humiliated people who tried to disagree with him or who disagreed with what he was saying. On the contrary, when we, in our press conference, when we would challenge or we would try to assert or go against, you know, what he's saying, he would explain to us. He took time, you know, that's the one thing. He took time to explain to us policies, governance, how he arrived at certain decisions. And so I think in some instances, these things would end with some people having a better appreciation of what the presidency or what the president is doing and what the presidency stands for.
Mm. Just a quick question before we let you go, Linda, on the energy that he had. You know, we were all so much more younger then when he started his presidency. But as I was telling our good friend Tony the other day, I vividly remember at the start of his presidency when you guys would cover him and he would be doing some sort of physical exercise, you know, like swimming laps in the pool, showing people how energetic he was and all that. How did you face that? That the president that you were covering had more energy than you, and yet you were younger than him by far.
Well, I put it down to his military training. You know, I never covered any of his, those exercise things. And I think the Defense Press Corps, who covered him also when he was not the longest, probably, because, you know, he was a military guy for almost 40 years. And then add to that, you know, the fact that he was defense secretary. So they've seen that particular side of him. And it must have been exhausting. I mean, we were already exhausted just showing up at the Villamor Air Base, Kangar, for our flights to the provinces on weekends. So how much more if you would want us to join him in some exercise. But he did, you know, it, of course, it's legendary that he's so someone from the north, no, Ilocano, Coripot, Pangasinense, as you would say. So this is not a president or a subject who gave out a lot of gifts or would lavish media with lunches or dinners or anything of the sort. It was a very frugal presidency, and you know, also towards the media. But at the same time, you know that he cared for a lot of the reporters. One time, it was election day, I think midterm, and we all went with him to Asinggan, where he cast his vote. I think either it was Asinggan or Lingayan. I think it was Asinggan. So he was going to stay the night there. So some of the vehicles and the choppers that he brought going there were going to be empty, no passengers. So he made dealing, you know, to the PSG, you know, okay, so bring these people back so that they don't have to suffer the 5-6 hour land travel. So you know that, you know, the media were not just there to cover him. They were not just there because they have a job to do, but he saw us as people as well, you know, even his constituents that he took care of.
Which brings us now to my final question, LJ. I talk to you now at a time when legacy media is under attack, not just here, but also all over the globe. What to you is his lasting legacy to press freedom and accountability?
As I said, it's the respect that he had for media and the role that media played. Or place in a democracy, and it's the willingness, you know, to subject himself to challenges or questions by the media whenever there were controversies. I cannot remember a time when President Ramos, you know, banned the media from going to Malacañang, and this was a time when we would still be able to go to Malacañang. Malacañang, in the succeeding presidencies, already became a fortress, and the media has just been relegated to, you know, the new executive building, one of the buildings in the compound. But, you know, he respected the media. He respected the role that media plays in a democracy. He made himself accessible to media because he knows that as president, it cannot be a one-way thing where he would just deliver statements and let the media propagate them. But he needed to put himself in a position where he can be challenged and can be held accountable for some of the statements and the decisions he had made.
And with that, we'd like to thank you, Executive Director of ABS-CBN News Digital, Linda Humida, there joining us this afternoon. Really appreciate it, Linda. Nice to see you again. I hope to see you here in the studio. It misses you.
Let's see. Thank you, Carmina. Thank you for inviting me.
Take care. And before we go now, K-pop superstars BTS may be allowed to perform even while they undertake their mandatory military service in South Korea. The defense minister says it could be in the national interest to find a way to keep the group on stage during their time in the military. All able-bodied men in South Korea under the age of 30 are mandated to perform around 2 years of military service. I know you're curious, so for more on this story, head on over to news.abs-cbn.com. And that'll do it for today. Thanks for joining us. I'm Carmina Constantino. If you want to revisit today's episode, you can play back this newscast on ANC's YouTube channel and on ANC 24/7 on Facebook. Keep safe. Keep it here on ANC.